This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Some communities in western Wisconsin have already seen flooding this year, as warmer weather brings rain and snow melt. But with several months of spring weather still ahead, the Cooley region isn't out of the danger of floods just yet. Joining us to talk about this year's spring flood outlook are John Wettenkamp, senior forecaster with the National Weather Service in La Crosse, Ed Hopkins, assistant state climatologist in Madison, and Keith Butler, La Crosse County Emergency Management Coordinator. So John, I wonder if you can start by talking a little bit about what we've seen so far with flooding. I know we experienced some in recent weeks.
Yes, we had some warmer temperatures across the region and some rainfall. What that resulted in was runoff of the deep snowpack that was in place across the region. Also, on top of that, we had some deep, underneath that, we had some deep frost cover across the region, so there really wasn't any place for that runoff to go. So that ran off the landscape into the riverways and resulted in some significant flooding in some areas. And unfortunately, we have not melted off all the snowpack yet. There's still more to go, especially north of the Interstate 90 corridor.
Yeah, and Keith, I wonder if you could talk about what this flooding kind of looked like on the ground and if it was anticipated.
Well, we certainly knew that was coming. We even got the warning that this is the kind of setup for the rapid snow melt. So we alerted all the communities, you know, just to be watching for that. But overnight is when people really started seeing the rapid rises, particularly along the smaller streams. The Cross River, for instance, we saw some rises outside of the village of West Salem that kind of took people unaware. They didn't realize it could come up that far that fast. And up in the town of Holland area, just west of Pullman, close to 75, 85 homes all reported some level of water in their basements.
I wonder how much, when these actions are taking place at night, how much that affects people's preparedness and ability to respond.
Well, certainly the traffic flow was much less, and that's helpful, but we still had a lot of people driving through areas where there was water across the roadway, and that's actually very, very dangerous, particularly at night and particularly at bridges and culverts, because you don't know if that bridge and culvert is still there.
And Ed, I wonder if this is, this kind of snow melt and flooding kind of we saw recently, if this is pretty typical for what we see in Wisconsin.
Well, it's unusual. We've had a few times in western Wisconsin where it's been even a lot worse. In fact, I think back to the spring, the March through May of 1965, when there was extreme flooding along the upper Mississippi, and La Crosse was hammered, and a lot of the communities, well, both up and downstream from La Crosse, were gotten. And in certain ways, it was quite similar. You had a lot of precipitation earlier on. It was cold, and then there was some rain, and it really, came down fast. The river came down past La Crosse. In fact, that's some of the record crests have been back in 1965.
John, when it comes to spring flooding, how much does it have to do with winter precipitation kind of leading into the spring season?
That's the main driver of the flooding, is the snow melt. And then what can really make that worse is, you know, how much frost is in the ground and also how much precipitation you receive, especially the latter part of the winter months. If you start getting heavy rains on top of snowpack, that's the worst case scenario.
Could you explain why the frost and maybe even the soil saturation heading into winter month, why that can play an impact?
Basically what that does is it freezes the ground solid across the area. We saw some heavy rains last fall, even parts of last summer, so our soil moisture is very high across the region. And once you freeze that in place, it's basically almost like a paved surface until you start melting some of that frost. So that just increases runoff. Any precipitation on top of that, it's going to go right into the river systems.
And so do you feel like this winter season was more active when it comes to precipitation?
Yes, it was. We had a little bit of a lull in January. We're kind of thinking, what's happening here? Are we going to actually get into a winter season? And indeed, we did. Most of the snow came in February. We had some record amounts in many areas. We saw record cold in January, so that helped get the frost even deeper into the ground than what we would typically see. And then we didn't have any warm-ups in February to help melt some of that deep snowpack across the region.
Ed, I wonder what your thoughts are on how this past winter kind of compared when it comes to precipitation.
Well, I took a look back, and the Wisconsin for the month of February was the second wettest, or at least the second highest amount of precipitation, both snow and liquid equivalent, like rain, going back to 1895. And in fact, and also for the what we call meteorological winter, the 3 months of December, January, February was also the second wettest. It was a record for the 6 months going back. And this, I'm also looking at the area specifically, the Western Wisconsin Climate Division and the Southeastern Minnesota Climate Division that surround the La Crosse area. And that was a record for the 6 months running from September of 2018 through February 2019. So, yes, there was a lot of precipitation. Now, admittedly, some of it earlier on was in the form of rain, and as what John was saying, that you saturated the ground beforehand.
Keith, I imagine with all of these factors playing out this winter, I imagine you kind of saw the writing on the wall when it comes to what spring is going to look like.
Well, we certainly have seen this before, and we have those record, you know, to serve as a benchmark. If it gets that bad, we know how bad it's going to be and how far it's going to extend. But we truly haven't had a significant Mississippi River flooding since 2001. We had some flooding in 2011, 2014, where it got high, and we making preparations, make sure you've got your stuff moved out of the lower levels if you live anywhere near the river. But it hasn't hit that peak. This year, it looks like it might be different. We've been battling flash flooding since 2007. Something changed.
Yeah, John, I wonder what your thoughts are on what the likelihood that the Mississippi River, we could see some severe flooding along that main corridor.
Yes, we're still anticipating flooding along the Mississippi River. Some areas are already experiencing some minor flooding. We should see that increase here over the next few weeks. And as we get into April, there's a lot of snowpack yet in the headwaters of the Mississippi River across Minnesota and into Wisconsin. We haven't released the water in that snowpack yet, so we're watching that very closely. The best case is we would have a slower melt, warm in the day, and then cool back down below freezing at night, kind of slow things down a bit so we don't send all that water down the Mississippi waterway quickly. So that would be the best case. But yeah, there's a lot of water yet held up in the headwaters of the Mississippi River.
Keith, how does flooding along the Mississippi River, how does response to that situation look different than flooding along its tributaries or some of these smaller waterways?
Well, we certainly know that it's coming. We have all of our communities upstream from us telling us what their circumstances are, and we can kind of gauge how soon and how bad it's going to be. So we have some heads up, and that helps. It helps those communities in the lower lying areas, particularly the town of Campbell, city of La Crosse, who have been impacted by La Crosse River as well as Mississippi River. They know what it's going to do and how high to move things to safety, put out their pumps, just take all the proactive measures that they have in the past. It's the flash flooding from those horrendous torrential rainstorms, that has changed their focus. And that's where we've been thinking for the last maybe 10, 12 years. It's not the river anymore. Well, this year, the river came back.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about spring flooding in the Coulee region. We're here with Keith Butler, La Crosse County Emergency Management Coordinator, John Wettenkamp, Senior Forecaster with the National Weather Service in La Crosse, and Ed Hopkins, Assistant State Climatologist in Madison. Ed, I want to hear your thoughts on this idea that Keith brought up, that we have seen some changes since 2007, 2008, when we started seeing kind of the rise in these flash flood events.
Oh, yes. Excuse me. It seems like the flash flood events, I can go back to the Kickapoo River back in, I believe, 2008. And there's a lot of different rivers in western, west central, and southwestern Wisconsin that have experienced, especially during the summertime when you have these thunderstorms, which contain a lot of water vapor, and then they produce torrential rains. In fact, it's not just only the total amount of precipitation, but it's how fast is the precipitation intensity, so many inches per hour. That is, becomes very important. And if they are slow-moving systems, and also if they train, that means individual thunderstorm cells move across the area. You can get, particularly in the Coulee Country, where you have a lot of the slopes running down, the steep slopes. The people up on top, the ridgelines, they're not going to worry too much or have too much of a problem. But it's particularly the people down along the river, like the La Crosse River also, and the Black, and, all these rivers, there is all that water accumulates because it's moving. It can't soak into the ground fast enough. And, of course, in the last several years, we've been having fairly moist soils, so therefore the ground becomes saturated quite rapidly, and so therefore that's an indication of disaster. And most of the, many of the floods are really the flash floods, and those are along the smaller tributaries. The Mississippi River, it gets all that water, but it seems like it the size of the Mississippi tends to damp out the individual smaller streams. The effects of the smaller streams.
Ed, do you feel like the prevalence of these events has increased enough to say that there really is a kind of a change?
Are you trying to say climate change?
I'm just asking maybe if there's a change in the prevalence of these events.
Well, there, looking back into the past, there have been more, excessive rain events. But we can also hark back to times, back in the 1940s, the record 24-hour precipitation was set up in northern Wisconsin. It was around 12 inches, and about the closest it had come back in 2007 or so. Can't remember the year, but it was Dan Baumgart, one of the meteorologists there. He recorded a almost an equivalent amount in a 24-hour period down at his place in southern La Crosse County. So, it's. You have these spikes, but we're concerned about the increased frequency.
Yeah, Keith, do you have thoughts on this issue?
Well, yeah, that's the same kind of things that we're hearing from our emergency responders and from the community leaders, that they're seeing greater intensity, but they're also happening far more frequently than they can ever remember. You get those interesting storms periodically, but we're getting them almost every year now. If we start adding the entire statewide, we add the Ashland, Bayfield, Douglas area, who've got hammered 3 or 4 years in a row. Our area of the state's gotten hammered 3 years in a row, resulting in presidential disaster declarations. We used to get one every 25. Now we're getting one almost every year.
John, when we talk about these flash flooding events, I know they're common in summer or fall. That's where we've seen them in the past. What's the likelihood that we might see them in the springtime setting?
In a springtime setting, they can happen. Typically, the air mass is most favorable to produce those intense rainfalls. Generally, stay south of our area. Typically, it will have what we call a warm front. that a lot of the heavy rain will focus along, and typically those weather systems stay south of us this time of year. It doesn't mean it can't happen, but typically the weather systems this time of year tend to be a little faster moving. We can still get heavy rainfall, but it moves through our area quicker. We don't stay in those air masses as long this time of year to produce that torrential and flash flooding rainfalls, but it can happen, just not as often as during the summer months.
And so if we were to see one of those heavy, intense rainfalls, what would that do to the water levels that we have in the area?
It would certainly, hopefully, some of those water levels have dropped by then, but there really just isn't anywhere for that water to go. Even if we lose the frost in the next week here or so locally, still the soils are going to be very saturated. They were already wet. The little bit that thawed and frost that thawed and the snow that melted into that, it's just going to be wet soil conditions and rapid runoff like we've been seeing under these wet conditions.
Keith, you know, we're talking about some potential changes to kind of what we see as far as flooding seasonally. But, you know, I wonder if you could talk about some of the reliable trends that we know happen in the springtime.
Well, certainly the Mississippi is always the one we watch out for in April. But we also have the severe weather, and the tornado week is coming up the second week of April. We have to start mindful that those kind of severe storms will start popping up anytime soon. We need to watch out for those as well. And we're still dealing with winter. We're still not out of that. So there's still road heave. There's all kinds of problems. They're counting the number of potholes, you know, just to see how bad this winter has been. So those we always have. This year is just far more intense.
John, I wonder if you also have thoughts on things we know that always kind of roll around this time of year when it comes to weather.
This time of year, it's changes is really rapid changes in the weather patterns. I mean, we can see one day of severe thunderstorms, tornadoes, damaging winds, heavy rain, followed by winter storm on the backside of that, where we have heavy snowfall. We can get particularly intense snowfalls this time of year. Like you've probably heard the term thunder snow, a really intense, almost like a thunderstorm, but it's snowing heavily during that. So you can get really intense snowfalls this time of year just as we're changing seasons. So rapid changes in the weather as we move closer to summer.
And when do we know that we're out of the woods? You know, how much longer are these rapid changes likely to continue to happen?
April is a very changeable weather month. So essentially all the way in through May, too, we can still end up in an active weather pattern. So really, I would anticipate, you know, these rapid fluctuations here in temperatures at least through the month of April and most likely through about mid-May before we start to really bring the warmer air into the region and turn the corner closer into the summer months.
Ed, I wonder what your thoughts are on, you know, kind of how much longer we should anticipate some of these, you know, spring-like weather patterns, and maybe if that's changed in the last few years, or if that's kind of a consistent pattern.
you know, we've had running the gamut, and my colleagues here, said things very well. We've had severe weather, in as early as March. In terms, when I call it severe weather, I should say severe thunderstorms. And of course, then they ramp up, and June typically has the most tornadoes in Wisconsin. But we can have fairly heavy snows. In fact, I can remember back in April of 1983, I believe, where we had I'd say about 12, 13 inches of snow in the Madison area, and it was a band of snow that came from eastern Iowa and went across a fair amount of Wisconsin. And then my wife's grandma, who lived in Juneau County, remembers a snowstorm of epic proportion, at least relatively so, because about 5-6 inches of snow fell on her birthday, which was the day before the old Memorial Day, in late May of 1947, and it caused significant damage to fruit trees that had blossomed, and so we can run the whole gamut.
Yeah, Keith, I wonder if you can talk about, you know, what are some of the kind of human and other impacts when it comes to having sort of these extreme weather conditions?
Well, certainly the local communities, the smaller ones, the townships, are reevaluating how they plot out new subdivisions, how they manage stormwater, because the old standards, building, you know, a 24-inch culvert was more than adequate for a 3-inch wide stream. Well, that's a nothing. Now, a 2-inch rain is commonplace and just wipes them out. So they're considering perhaps we should be doing box culverts, you know, concrete structures and those kind of things, hardening their infrastructure because they're tired of repairing the same road sections over and over again because of these massive, intense storms that have been pouring through. It's very costly, and we need to get ahead of that. Mitigation is tough. How do you prepare? How do you make things better, not knowing how severe things are going to be?
Do you think we're going to see more communities continue to respond to this change in the frequency of these severe storms and you know, being forced to make infrastructure changes?
I think so. And they're looking for leaders such as Ed and John and others, the hydrologists, to tell us what has the trend been and what could it possibly be? Because we have to think in terms of worst case. We can't build to just the old standards of it never happening, because it's now it's happening all the time. Should we be dealing with a more intricate, a more robust stormwater system? Should we just not build homes adjacent to streams? So there's a lot of things for them to think about when they want their communities to thrive, but they also don't want them to be damaged all the time.
Ed, what are your thoughts on, you know, the way that these changes in climate and weather are impacting the way we should think about building our communities?
Well, I can appreciate Keith's discussion about culverts, because when I was in the service, I was helping build culverts in the Corps of Engineers. Well, anyhow, you know, they have to take a look, and the NOAA, which is National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has done a good job at updating what they call the NOAA 14 Atlas, which provides the users, local governmental officials and the public and various other people with updated information as to precipitation intensity and they couch this in terms of various recurrence intervals, which explains, like, say, for example, about the amount of precipitation in an event, say, a 100-year flood. Well, that's you only get precipitation that's 1 in 100 times in the period of record, and now we can take a look, or the emergency managers and various other local governments can take a look at the these intensities, and then their engineers can build the infrastructure based upon that.
John, obviously the National Weather Service plays a crucial role in updating municipal leaders when it comes to emergency management and responding to these sorts of severe weather. But I wonder if you guys have seen more of a trend in, you know, municipal or county leaders reaching out to kind of look at this proactively.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a big part of what we do. It's not just in the preparation side of it, but when disaster strikes, is ensuring that we're there to provide weather support for them. So be it leading into the event, make sure they're informed on the weather forecasts, what can be expected from the weather, potential impacts from that weather, and then even after the event has occurred, continuing that support through the recovery process.
And how can this, information and data we know about weather patterns in this region influence, things like Keith was talking about, how we're thinking about building our communities and the infrastructure that supports them?
The biggest thing is being prepared, knowing your risks in your area, being prepared for that, and have a way to receive warnings to be able to respond to those threats in your community.
John Wettenkamp, senior forecaster with the National Weather Service in La Crosse, is here with us today to talk about this year's spring flood outlook, how communities have been affected by flooding so far this season, and what's likely to come in the next few weeks. He's joined by Ed Hopkins, assistant state climatologist in Madison, and Keith Butler, La Crosse County Emergency Management Coordinator. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on spring flooding and how communities can prepare. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. It's starting to feel like spring here in the Cooley region, and with it comes an increased chance for flooding in the area. Rapid snowmelt and rain have already caused flooding in some communities in the region, and some weather experts say more flooding is likely on the horizon. Joining us today to talk about the spring flood outlook are John Wettenkamp, senior forecaster with the National Weather Service in La Crosse, Ed Hopkins, assistant state climatologist for Wisconsin, and Keith Butler, La Crosse County Emergency Management Coordinator. Earlier in the show, we talked a little bit about the flooding we've already seen this season, but John, I wonder if you can just briefly kind of talk about what the situation looks like now.
Now we are still expecting significant flooding across the region from additional snowmelt, particularly in north of La Crosse area. A lot of the snowpack melted to our south. However, there's still a lot to come through. It's still anticipating, at a minimum, minor flooding at many locations, particularly along the Mississippi River. We could even see major flooding. It's really going to depend on how quickly we melt the snowpack in the headwaters of the Mississippi and future precipitation. So it boils down to temperature trends and precipitation trends as we go through the rest of the spring months, which will determine the magnitude of the flooding that we experience.
And Keith, do you have a sense that individuals and communities have cleaned up from the flooding we've seen so far and maybe are ready for this next round potentially?
I'm guessing not. I think this is probably the week that they're trying to recover from what happened over the last weekend. But those aren't necessarily areas that are impacted by the Mississippi River. It could be a new group of people who are quite familiar with that. You know, they know what happens when the river gauge says 13.5, this is what's gonna look like in my backyard. So I'm hoping that they're already starting their plans. How am I gonna move my things out of the lower level, get them up to the higher level, and all the other typical preparations we encourage people to do. Make sure their flood insurance is up to date and make sure they have a B plan for getting out if your A plan isn't working well. So we think those things are happening, but people are just very, very uncertain. And Hope, I should also mention that people who have experienced this flash flooding over the last several years are getting a little weary of that. And they're a little nervous when they see these forecasts and its potential. People are impacted by it in a very deep and meaningful way. And we're hearing from some of my peers and other emergency managers that some communities are just saying, we don't want to do this anymore. People are leaving. Do we have to move our entire town like Gaze Mills and Soldiers Grove did? What do we have to do now to ensure that we don't have to live through this thing again?
How can counties and communities, provide resources for those people, help those people in these situations that are continually being impacted by severe weather?
It's a very difficult question because it usually does not happen from the local level. Those resources are few and far between and typically are focused on infrastructure and managing the road systems and the things that are under the direct control of the local units of government. We're so dependent upon federal aid for the major disasters, and I think the winds of change are blowing that it's not going to be as available, it's not going to be as extensive, and people are going to have to come up with a better way of managing their own individual and home kind of losses. It's rare that we even get that individual assistance grant program from FEMA. And when we do, it doesn't even come close to covering all of your losses. This last year, the maximum payout was about $35,000 if you lose your home and all of its contents, and that certainly is not enough. People need to think, what can I be doing to get myself in better shape if the inevitable should occur?
John, I wonder what advice the National Weather Service cautions people with as they prepare for spring floods.
If you live in an area that has experienced flooding before, be prepared for additional flooding this spring. Also monitor forecasts closely, any precipitation area precipitation trends. Be ready to receive watches and warnings for your area if those are issued. If you live along a riverway where there's river forecasts available, watch those very closely and just kind of pre-staging things to move if necessary if the water levels rise and produce significant flooding.
You know, Ed, Keith brought up the fact that along the Mississippi River, people kind of know what flooding looks like because of historic floods we've seen in the past. And I know that it has been brought up in the conversation, the 1965 flood. And Ed, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about kind of what that flood looked like and maybe how that changed the way we think about flooding in Wisconsin.
Well, I think, in fact, a lot of the information, well, I remember the flood through my wife, who was in La Crosse and helped sandbag during that event during her spring break at a terrible college. And you know, the pictures that appear on the website that that Jeff Boyne from the National Weather Service forecast office there in La Crosse have put out, you know, they show a lot of information. You know, there was a aerial photograph looking across the area, and everything was flooded. At least a lot of the northern parts of La Crosse, city of La Crosse, were flooded. And then, of course, then all the people that, that he got, you know, he interviewed, or at least there was people had certain recollections and such. So that's impressive. But, yeah, I think, you know, there have been some floods like back in the 50s and such. But I think that a lot of people woke up to the fact at that time that, of course, that was the highest crest level that moved down the Mississippi. You know, you know, various communities like Winona to up to the north and La Crosse, and then farther on down towards the south, Lansing, Iowa, and places. They, you know, they had records which still stand today as record crests. I think that that 1965, you know, for the people, that was something for at least now. I guess we're all old timers. You know, is the benchmark.
Yeah, John, I wonder if you could expand on that. How the 1965 flood maybe, you know, set a new benchmark.
Yes, it did indeed. I mean, the community impacts all along the Mississippi River were rather severe. It was certainly a high-impact event. That's what we're going to have to watch for this year. There is a potential to see crests maybe in the top five, hopefully not another record crest, but the potential's there given just how much snowpack is in place upstream of our area. So we're going to have to watch that carefully. Worst case, we'd get heavy rainfall across the region, combined with the snowmelt heading downstream. And the potential is there for a flood of that magnitude. So really keep a close eye on river forecasts.
Keith, what did emergency management and other officials learn maybe from the 1965 flood? And I wonder how that maybe changed kind of our approach.
Well, I wasn't here then. I was living in Michigan at the time. But I have learned that it changed from being just sort of a reactive kind of dealing with floods and natural disasters to try to do some mitigation, try to do some things in advance to lessen the impact of that. And certainly La Crosse is no stranger to that. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers built those temporary levees back in 1965 to help out with that particular flood, but they weren't made to permanent standards. the City of La Crosse has attempted to maintain them, try to keep them viable, but it's really not the same as what you find further down south, say in Mississippi or Tennessee, where there's permanent levee structures along those communities. That may be something they'll have to reevaluate. If we're starting to see greater Mississippi River flooding again, we're going to have to change our focus. Do we need to do something that's a permanent fix to help keep those neighborhoods high and dry?
I know that when it comes to levees and other infrastructure to kind of keep out floodwaters, you know, there have been other issues downstream of kind of passing that on to the next community by creating a more permanent structure. I mean, do you feel like that's something we're going to have to evaluate?
Oh, absolutely. We witnessed that just within the last few days in Nebraska, where levees were protecting entire communities and doing a great job under normal circumstances, blew out. And when that happened, not only were the communities impacted, they were destroyed by the amount of mud and crud coming down rapidly. So it's a two-edged sword. You want that defense, you want some sort of capability, but you have to understand it. When it does fail, and it will eventually, the ramifications are intense.
You know, when it comes to talking about levees, I wonder, Keith, if you can talk about maybe how technology has changed when it comes to responding to these sorts of flooding events. You know, what do we have available now that we maybe didn't have in previous flood events?
Well, we're looking at high water vehicles, you know, the kind that have the air intake, like on a snorkel, so it's higher, so you can drive through deeper water, higher elevated machinery to do that. Swift water rescue boats. Communities never had that back in the 1960s, and nor were emergency responders truly prepared for flood emergencies. Firemen were called upon to remove water, and that's not their typical job. Their job was to put water on something. It's a different approach. It's a different world. So now emergency responders are trained, equipped, geared up for dealing with those kind of hazards that they never had to deal with before.
I wonder if in some way there's a futility to preparing for floodwaters. I mean, is there really anything, Keith, that communities can do to kind of keep waters out when we have things like snowmelt and precipitation?
Well, I certainly don't want to be entirely negative in my understanding of all of this, but I think that's the futility of it all, that the only way to avoid being flooded is to not be by the flood. So do you move your entire community to higher ground and hope that the water doesn't come down from the hills as it did during 2007, 2008? What do you do to make your community more resilient? You start with the basics and just evaluate what homes, what structures are in harm's way now. What can we do to elevate them, perhaps get them away from that circumstance? And we've also been focusing on property buyouts. After the second, third, fourth time of paying for disaster costs for a home, maybe it's time to not live there anymore and just give those people the money they need to reestablish in the higher ground.
Ed, I wonder what your thoughts are on whether in some ways responding to floods is a difficult job when the high waters are inevitable.
Oh, yeah. But also, you know, I wanted to go back a little bit because you were asking about the technology of response. I think that since like say the 1960s, at least some of the public has become more appreciative of the information that has been gotten out by the National Weather Service and by other organizations. Because now we have satellites. That are very high-resolution satellites that you can see clouds moving across the sky. You can even see the snowpack along the river systems and how the river systems have swollen. You got the radar that provides a much better coverage than even some of the very a few systems that were out there in the 1960s, where we can not only see how much precipitation is falling currently, but they can also take a look and can see the accumulated precipitation for a particular storm event or a few, for a day or so. So they can get a feeling about the amount of precipitation that's falling, especially upon the the soil that may be saturated. And of course, then there's also various additional things such as the National Drought Monitor. And I say why I bring up the term drought. Well, because the drought monitors, which is a group from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln in conjunction with the National Weather Service and the USDA and various other organizations, looks at the soil moisture, at least to a certain extent, so you can get a feeling about what areas that may have a lot of soil moisture versus those that don't have it. So a lot of this, I think that because the National Weather Service is trying to save lives, and they are doing their darndest to make sure that the information that they get, the weather information that they get, is sent out to the public in a timely fashion. And so there's a lot of effort nowadays on the social aspects about ensuring that the people understand the situation and help them to react to it.
John, I wonder if you could respond to this idea of how technology has maybe improved the National Weather Service ability to forecast some of these disasters, but also get the information out to the public.
Absolutely. It's come a long way, especially since 1965. We have very advanced radar systems now. We can actually tell what type of precipitation is falling from the sky. Is it snow? Is it rain? Is it hail? We can tell that now. High-resolution satellite data, we can better assess environments conducive for heavy rainfall, where the heavy rainfall is occurring. So there's certainly been advancements in our sensing of the environment, so to speak. Also, advancements in the way that we can get the message out. We have social media now has been a great tool for us. Via media sources, emergency alert system. There's just many, many avenues now that we can get the information out there for the people that need to get it and be able to really express what the impact is. What do they need to do? What does this mean? Okay, I'm under a warning. What does that mean for me exactly? And how should I respond to that? And including that information within our services.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about spring flooding in the Coulee region. We're here with John Wettenkamp, senior forecaster with the National Weather Service in La Crosse, Ed Hopkins, assistant state climatologist in Madison, and Keith Butler, La Crosse County Emergency Management Coordinator. Keith, I wonder if you could talk about how social media maybe has also improved, emergency response's ability to contact the public and make them aware.
Well, certainly situational awareness has vastly improved. I was just remembering, thinking back when Ed and John were talking, we used to have to wait until the 6 o'clock evening news on television to find out what was going on, or listen to local AM/FM radio stations, just occasionally find out what is happening in my community. Now you can get that information instantly wherever you are and at any time in multiple formats. So it's incredible how much information is being pumped out at us. Sometimes it's a little bit of an information overload too, and I think some people are tuning it out and they're not really paying attention because they don't understand why they need to listen. And that's extremely important. You just can't tell them a flood is coming, take precautions. You have to tell them, why is this important to me before people actually take action? We've had a wonderful case study from the Joplin tornado on May 22nd of 2011, where people were being interviewed. And what did you do when you first heard the warning? And it turned out that people were waiting until they got confirmation from 5, 6, 7 sources before they even took any action at all, and that was deadly. We need to change things. We need to figure out how to really reach people in the way that's appropriate to them, in a way that they respond to, so they can take the actions ahead of time before the situation gets out of control.
How do we improve that? How do we get people to buy into, active preparation and maybe even thinking about preparedness, things like drills?
That has been a long-standing challenge. I think it's going to be a struggle forever. People really don't want to think about the unthinkable occurring in their life. They're aware of it's happening all over the place, all over the world. You can see instantly who's having a flood, who's having a tornado, who's having a typhoon. but you don't want to think that it's going to happen in my backyard too. And that's tough. That's a sociology issue. How do we get people to really engage? And unfortunately, hope that the triggers have been something had to happen locally before people really thought about it.
John, what are your thoughts on how we get people to buy into preparedness and really taking these sorts of weather alerts seriously?
I think a lot of it has to do with awareness. I know for local communities, we participate in like tabletop exercises, preparedness activities, getting the community leaders prepared and some members of the community. But yeah, it really boils down to, you know, what does this mean for me? What is this warning? What is this watch? What is this advisory? What do I do with this information? And then, like Keith had said during the Joplin assessment, it was determined that people need additional confirmation, and usually that has to come from a known source, a family member, a friend, or they have to see it themselves. So there's essentially almost like three forms of things that need to happen, three things that need to happen before somebody actually will take action in a situation like that. And I think it's really, you need to verify the threat is what you really need to do. If we have a picture of, say, that here's what's happening in this community as far as, you know, here's flooded roadways, here's what's happening now, this is coming your way, here's a tornado on the ground, there's a picture of it, it's heading towards your community, you know, this is an emergency situation where you need to act. So you need to provide that confirmation once you're in the warning mode where you need to act to save your life.
Ed, I wonder what your thoughts are on people kind of taking these sorts of weather alerts seriously, especially as we do see more of these severe weather events.
Well, that is a tough one, speaking from some. One who knows some of the people in the National Weather Service, it is a big social issue. But from my angle, I provide information, past information, because somebody will contact me and say, hey, how much snow fell over the last several months? Now, sure, some of it might be just they want to find out if a condo association is ripping them off in terms of how much snow was plowed, but some of them are interested in how much also how much rain that fell over the last little bit, so they can get some sort of an indication as how much has the soil become saturated, and of course, and I also provide information, looking at the NOAA 14 atlas, which tells about the intensity rates, how many inches of precipitation, how often does that occur, that type of thing, and of course also. Maybe in certain cases, looking back at, like, say, for example, helping people to locate information on that 1965 spring flood or some of the floods that occurred beforehand. The website that there in La Crosse with the National Weather Service and elsewhere, they have information for various floods, not just only spring floods, but also the summertime ones on the local rivers like the Kickapoo or the Black or the La Crosse rivers, that type of a thing.
Keith, you brought up earlier that, we're not just talking, when it comes to spring weather, we're not just talking about flooding. There's also, we start getting into the possibility of tornadoes or other sorts of severe situations. And I know the 2019 state tornado drill is coming up. I wonder if La Crosse County is doing anything to participate in that.
Well, certainly we're advocating that all schools certainly would participate in some fashion to exercise how you move the children to a safe location, to understand where that is and why. But also homeowners, businesses also need to be doing that too. And I think that that's been a difficult sell, that would be a great day for that 1 hour of time just to have your employees demonstrate what do you intend to do if the alarm is received, that a tornado has been sighted, tornado is moving in our direction. And I think people are hesitant to do that, thinking it's not a return on my cost. You know, I don't want to slow down my business. I want to impact my customers. But you really need to. You really need to understand how are you going to get all 300 people in your Walmart store to a place of safety. You need to practice that. What a great time to do it. It's hard to convince people to do that, however.
And John, as we look towards the end of spring and maybe even into summer, I wonder if you could briefly explain how this spring weather could impact what we see this summer.
Well, there's what we call a weak El Nino conditions in place, and Ed can probably provide a little more detail on that. This summer, it appears that we're going to kind of approach summer under weak El Nino conditions, maybe a little drier, fortunately, maybe a little warmer. However, if El Nino continues, there are some signals that indicate we could have a little wetter of a summer pattern in some regions, but they can be variable as well. But hopefully that holds, that we dry out. We don't have any heavy precipitation on top of the saturated soil conditions. Give the soil time to dry out a bit and prepare for any of those intense rainfalls that we could receive this summer.
John Wettenkamp, Senior Forecaster with the National Weather Service in La Crosse, Keith Butler, La Crosse County Emergency Management Coordinator, and Ed Hopkins, Assistant State Climatologist for Wisconsin. Joining us today to talk about this year's spring flood outlook and other severe weather, and how communities are preparing. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.